Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When James K. Polk became president in 1845, U.S. territory in the Southwest formally ended on the western border of Louisiana. By the time his single term ended 4 years later, the southwestern U.S. encompassed Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, Utah, Nevada, and California. That's quite the expansion. It all came from Mexico, and it still echoes today, this hour on point, the long, deep legacy of the Mexican-American War. You can join the conversation. What do you know about the Mexican War and the great westward expansion of the United States in those years? Do you remember any details from school beyond Manifest Destiny? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Robert Mary, former president and editor-in-chief of Congressional Quarterly. He's author of A Country of Vast Designs, James K. Polk, The Mexican War, and the Conquest of the American Continent. Bob Mary, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
This is quite a story. It's such a gigantic backstory to so much that's in the news these days. Your book came out last fall, but we thought we should have you on just to kind of reset the frame and get the context back fresh in mind. I wonder if you'd be good enough to just play sort of map maker and a big political map drawer at the same time. Give us the picture of the United States, 1845, inauguration day for James K. Polk, and first just territorially, what things looked like, and what do we have in the Southwest and West?
Well, I think it's important to note also that under James Polk's one term, we also got Oregon Territory,
yes,
or most of Oregon Territory.
54-40 or fight, and off we went there, yeah.
Yeah, and we didn't get to 54-40. Mm-hmm. It ended up at the 49th parallel, but mm-hmm. that was Washington, Oregon, Idaho, parts of Montana, and parts of Wyoming. So he really expanded the United States territorial footprint by a third, which was, as you note, very, very dramatic. I think that the important thing was that there was something brewing in America at that time, at the time of his inauguration. By the mm-hmm. way, it was a very rainy day. Everybody got drenched mm-hmm. on that particular day. But Polk made it very clear that he wanted a claim to all of Oregon Territory. He didn't mm-hmm. get it.
Which the British had held partly along with the United States until that time.
That's correct. It had been a joint occupation because they really couldn't come to terms in terms of where the line should be. Mm-hmm. What had been unleashed, though, was this very powerful sentiment in America that we could, in fact, become a country that could stretch from one ocean to the other, that could dominate the North American continent in such a way as to become a nation the like of which the world had never seen before. My thesis is that this kind of emerged most powerfully with the advent of Texas annexation, which emerged initially under Polk's predecessor, John mm-hmm. Tyler, who mm-hmm. inherited the office. Polk then brought about the final moves that brought Texas into the Union. And as soon as that happened, this vision, this dream of what America could become really sort of embedded itself in the American consciousness. And the rest is history, as you say, and it's quite a dramatic story.
Help us understand the Texas piece, because this was the fuse already burning when Polk came to office. And, of course, Texans had been fighting for their own republic. What were the series of things? Where does Alamo fit in here? It comes before the Mexican-American War. The series
10
of steps,
years before.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Mexico had been concerned about the fact that it didn't really have the population to maintain control over Texas. For that matter, it didn't have the population or the military or the money to maintain control over California. Mm-hmm. And its control over the Southwest, the vast Southwest, was pretty tenuous. So along about the 1820s, they offered land to Anglos, Americans, mm-hmm. if they would come across. And Stephen A. Austin amassed a huge amount of land, which he then sold to pioneers who were willing to come from the United States. Mexico found itself at odds with these American settlers, if you will, over the state of the government. Mexico was becoming increasingly centralized as a government. The Texans didn't like that very much. They declared their independence, fought for it, won it 10 years before. The point that I think has to be borne in mind by all the listeners is that Mexico never acknowledged or accepted the loss of Texas,
right,
even though it had no ability to do anything about it. You could argue that that was maybe somewhat frivolous as a policy on the part of Mexico. Mm-hmm. Texas was recognized by almost every major Western nation. But nevertheless, that was Texas's position. So as soon as annexation emerged with John Tyler's resolve to negotiate an annexation, relations between the United States and Mexico became rather hostile, and that was a contributor to the eventual Mexican War.
You wrap the story, and quite rightly, around James K. Polk, who had such determination to see this expansion. But it wasn't clear, not long before his election, that he'd ever emerge as anything like a president, a real dark horse, maybe the first dark horse candidate to fill that role. How did he recognize this expansionist sentiment in the populace when his competitors for the office did not?
Well, Polk, I think it's interesting to note that James K. Polk, a year before he became president, was a political washout. He had a 14-year career in the House. He'd been Speaker
Tennessee.
Of the House. He'd been, correct, from Tennessee. He was a great protege of Andrew Jackson, his great mentor. He had been chairman of the Ways and Means. He'd been governor of Tennessee. But he lost the governorship after his first two-year term, tried again 2 years later to get that seat, that office back, failed again, and was considered a complete political dud. He concluded that the only way he was going to get back into national politics was to see if he couldn't catch the vice presidential nomination. Back in those days, you could actually run for the vice presidency within your party. And that's what he did. It wasn't going very well, but what happened, and Texas then becomes a significant part of the story, both the clear Whig nominee, Henry Clay, and the putative Democratic nominee, Martin Van Buren, had been president, lost it, wanted it back, came out against immediate annexation. And in doing so, they put themselves thwart the clear national sentiment. Polk, being a great Jacksonian and an expansionist, saw that this was his opportunity, and he embraced annexation of Texas very, very powerfully. And when the Democratic Convention in Baltimore in the spring of 1844 deadlocked, Polk emerged as a compromise candidate. So he managed to resurrect himself from practically political ashes.
Who did the Whigs think would be opposed to expansion in those days?
Well, there were some voices in mostly in the Northeast. There were people who were concerned about the war with Mexico. There was also people who were concerned about any expansion because of what it would do in terms of the sort of sleeping slavery issue. They wanted to let that sleeping dog lie, but they knew that if the country began to expand, new territory came in, the big question would be free or slave, and that we would be back to where we were before the Missouri Compromise, where the two regions of the country were struggling to maintain a kind of political parity between the two of them.
Emerson wrote, watching all this, the United States will conquer Mexico. They said, but Mexico will poison us.
Well, that was not a uncommon sentiment at that time, Tom. I think it's really very interesting. When we essentially conquered half of Mexico, planted the flag, the American flag, in the heart of Mexico City atop their most hallowed civic buildings, and they still, the Mexicans, would not negotiate a settlement. The question arose in Congress and in Washington and throughout the country, are we going to just take over the whole country? And there were a lot of people at that time, including Henry Clay, including John C. Calhoun, and many others who were very much opposed to this, in part because they thought that the cultural differences, and here's where we really get into what's happening today in a way, mm-hmm. because they thought that the cultural differences were so significant and large that the assimilation equation would prove to be very, very difficult and would harm both Mexico and the United States. And that viewpoint ultimately prevailed, and we got Mexico to negotiate a settlement, and that's when we captured all that land that you spoke of.
So it didn't take all of Mexico, but took an awful lot of it. This is an enormous swath of the United States today, and your man James Polk, President Polk, seemed to have no doubt about it. He was a man of destiny in his self-understanding.
Yeah, he really was. He saw himself as a man of destiny, and it's interesting to note that he really lacked most of the traits of a natural leader of men or leader of people. He was a sanctimonious, a bit of a prig. He did not know how to deal with people very well. He wasn't likable particularly. He didn't amass friends. He didn't know how to build a team. All of those things were severe political liabilities. But he had one thing in spades, and that was an ironclad determination to bring about whatever he set before himself. And he was a total patriot. He really believed that in American greatness, and he wanted to be a man who was going to further that along.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Mexican-American War, the president who drove it, and its resonance today in Arizona and the American Southwest. Robert Mary is with us. He's author of A Country of Vast Designs, James K. Polk, The Mexican War and the Conquest of the American Continent. Bob Mary, take us back then to the beginning of this single term, and he was only going to serve one term, he said, and he had his goals right at the outset. How did he begin to execute on these goals? What happened?
He was the only president that I'm aware of who promised to serve only one term at the point of getting the nomination. In mm-hmm. other words, he said that as he was facing the voters for the fall campaign. He made it very clear from the very beginning in his inaugural address that he wanted he laid claim to all of Oregon Territory. The Brits went crazy. Speeches in Parliament, the Times of London was saying that he was basically perpetrating an act of war with these expressions. He embraced the annexation of Texas, which had been set in train by, as I say, his predecessor, John Tyler. In doing that and in embracing an approach to bringing Texas into the Union, he set himself up to essentially exploit the tensions that he knew were going to arise between the United States and Mexico over the annexation of Texas.
He sent General Zachary Taylor to Texas, advancing toward the Rio Grande.
I think it's it should be noted, in fairness to Polk, and he gets a lot of criticism in history for some of the things he did, and much of it's justified. But Mexico immediately withdrew its ambassador to the United States. It cut off diplomatic relations. It was waxing very, very bellicose towards the United States, saying that we had perpetrated an act of war and that they weren't going to take it. So, yes, indeed, Polk sent an army down to the Rio Grande. Now, bear in mind that the territory between the Rio Grande River and the Nueces River was in dispute even at this point. If we could get Mexico to accept Texas annexation, it was still an open question whether they would say that the border was at the Nueces River, which is what they mm-hmm. did say, or whether it was at the Rio Grande. So when he sent troops to the Rio Grande, he was sending troops into what was essentially disputed territory. He would argue, as he did, that it might be disputed by them, but it wasn't disputed by him, and he felt a need to protect that land which Texans had claimed and which we now brought into the United States through the annexation of Texas.
He had a lot of pushback from one young congressman, Abraham Lincoln, at that point, called it an unnecessarily and unconstitutionally begun war by the president, and was hounding the White House to know exactly where this confrontation with Mexican forces had occurred. Lincoln didn't believe Polk's story.
No, Lincoln picked up a nickname, Spotty Lincoln, because he wanted to know, where is that spot on American soil? Polk said when he went to Congress after a skirmish had led to the death of, I think, 11 Americans, he said, they have shed American blood on the American soil. And Lincoln wanted to know, well, where is that spot on the American soil? Where is that spot? And he used that term so often and repeatedly that he became known as Spotty Lincoln. Actually, Lincoln's almost venomous animus towards Polk contributed to his not being in position to retain his seat in Congress from Illinois. But nevertheless, he was eloquent and very, very effective in debunking much of the Polk myth.
Was he right? Had Polk misrepresented where this skirmish had occurred?
No, Polk said that it was on American soil. Various people could argue, and many Americans did argue, that it was not American soil. It was disputed soil. But that was a debate that we could have on this program. Mm-hmm. We could go
Even
on
today.
Endlessly.
Right.
And it's all part of this sort of ongoing controversy, as you note, that really stems from that period but is still sort of alive with this today and some of the immigration issues that we're seeing in Arizona.
Well, how was it that Mexico was so vulnerable then? That Winfield Scott could put his troops ashore further south in Mexico and march into Mexico City and make this demand. The United States ultimately paid a big sum, but nevertheless, it was force of arms that made it possible. Why was Mexico so open?
Mexico was a dysfunctional country. I make that a point very clearly in the book. I have a chapter called The United States and Mexico, and I go back into explaining the differences in the origins of the United States and its government and its culture and its systems and those of Mexico, and they were very, very different. Ours turned out to be very effective, and Mexico's turned out to be very ineffective. And when they received their independence from Spain in 1821, it really was not a country that was either stable or that could generate much wealth, that could generate much population increase. My recollection is that in 1790, the United States population was about 4 million. The population of Mexico was 5 million. And by, I think, maybe 1820 or 1840, the population of the United States was 17 million. And the population of Mexico was merely 7 million. So they were not in a position to really retain those lands because you can't retain lands unless you can settle lands. That was the rule of thumb then, and I think it's still the rule of thumb today. But I will say this about Mexico and the Mexicans during that episode. Mm-hmm. They never won a battle against either Winfield Scott or Zachary Taylor, and yet they had so much heart and patriotism and strong feelings about their nation that they never wanted to give up, and they refused, no matter how devastating the military circumstances proved to be.
They had their own version of the Alamo right in the middle of Mexico City.
They did.
The boy heroes. Let's go to our listeners. Ted in Toronto. You're on the air, Ted.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Thanks very much for this topic. I'd like to ask your guest. I spent a lot of time in Mexico and worked there, and from kind of a Mexican perspective, I'd like to know what he thinks of the general and President Antonio López de Santa Anna, who kind of fought with the Americans and to defend Mexican territory, and at the same time, he seemed to be dealing secretly with them to allow the territory to be ceded to the U.S. I'd just like to hear his opinion of that very important man in Mexican history.
Yes, great. Santa Ana. Thanks, Ted. Bob Mary.
Oh, it's a great question because he truly is one of the most fascinating figures in the whole book, and there's a lot of powerful figures in this tale. But I will say that in this chapter on the Mexican history, I tell pretty much the last 20 years of that history pretty much through the person of and the career of Santa Anna. I describe him as the irrepressible man in Mexico. He was up and down. He was forced into exile in Cuba before he came back during the Mexican War. But he had been forced into exile back to his orchards and his farm many times, and yet he just rose from the ashes and found himself back in power. And It's true. He had an emissary, a guy by the name of Atoka, who came to Washington, met with Polk and Thomas Hart Benton, the senator from Missouri, and others, and basically indicated that if they would somehow get Santa Anna back into Mexico, he would negotiate a favorable peace with the Americans. It was a total ruse. He snookered the President of the United States, who desperately wanted that to happen because he really wanted that territory, but he didn't really want to have to fight a war for it. But that was a typical Santa Anna maneuver. The guy was truly irrepressible.
Give us a sense of what Polk's full ambitions were. He wanted more of Mexico than he ended up with. Some in the South, even, you remind us, as you say, wanted all of Mexico. There was concern that Mexico would end up as America's Ireland, I think you quote some folks there. But what did Polk aspire? What was his full aspiration?
It's really not absolutely clear in the diary and in the papers. He would have been pleased to get more territory than we ended up getting, but I don't think Polk was ever in the group of people who wanted to get all of Mexico. And I've got to make a point here that has to do with the cultural considerations. Bear in mind that California had approximately 5,000, in all of California, 5,000 people at the time of the beginning of the Mexican War, and only 4,000 of those were of Mexican or Hispanic origin. The rest were European and American. The vast Southwest, those states that you mentioned, in New Mexico and along Nevada and Utah and Arizona, had about 80,000 people. So that was significantly more populous, but still not a high population area.
Are you Texas, including Native Americans when you lay out these numbers?
No, I'm afraid that Native Americans don't figure in this history because unfortunately were not in a position to affect events significantly.
But so interestingly, they become part of history now when many people coming over the border would have in no small part Native American ancestry.
Well, I'm talking about people who were Mexicans at that time, some would have been of Indian extraction,
right.
And some would have been of Hispanic extraction. And I don't draw a distinction there because I don't know the proportions. I think the main point is that the territory that the Americans, that the United States wanted, was largely territory that was not very populated because they wanted basically to fill that population themselves.
He wanted the Baja also, I think President Polk did, and maybe transit rights across southern Mexico, even if they didn't take the whole country.
He wanted that because of potential canal or railroad so that the shipping could go from Atlantic to Pacific and back. He had vast dreams, and he also flirted with the idea of buying Cuba from Spain. He was rebuffed in that.
Let's go to Dave calling from Plattsburgh, New York. Dave, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Fascinating subject. I was wondering if the all Mexico solution actually might have been the best solution given our history since the Treaty of Guadalupe signing, because it seems like, you know, Mexico continues to suffer and they continue to send their laborers to the United States, in many cases illegally, and we continue to accept them. And on the other hand, for us, California was really, well, California being the sixth, I think, largest economy in the world, has been a tremendous success story for the United States. And had we gone with the all-Mexico solution to that war that we so handily won, who's to say it wouldn't have been, you know, a fantastic marriage?
Bob Mary, what do you say?
Well, it certainly would have obviated the whole illegal immigration issue because there wouldn't be any illegal immigrants from that period, from that area, unless, of course, they came from further south. It's an interesting equation, and it's interesting what might have been kind of question. And yet the political forces and the forces of culture and culture consciousness of that time really made it almost impossible for the United States to accept that concept. And if you go back and read the debates and listen to, I sort of listen because they jangle in my mind, but the debates, reading the debates of people like John C. Calhoun, who clearly was had racialist views, Henry Clay, much less so, but felt the same way, felt that the cultural clash, if we brought it right into our own country, would retard our ability to be the country that that people had in mind.
Let's go to John in Lexington, Virginia. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am interested in slavery and how it, the expansion of slavery into Texas and how it affected the Mexican government, whether the Mexican government objected to slavery being on its territory or not.
That's a very interesting question, John. Let us pick it up. And if you would, Bob Mary, if you could look at that and how this expansion changed the balance and maybe set the stage for the Civil War in the United States.
Oh, one of my main theses of this book is that the Polk's foreign policy really rendered the Civil War irrepressible. But Mexico did not have slavery. It had outlawed slavery. When the Texans declared their independence and for 10 years essentially had independence, they allowed slavery, so obviously it was a slave state. I don't know that that was a major issue in the tensions that arose between Mexico and the United States at the point of annexation, Mexico had a government that looked down on slavery, thought that it was totally wrong and outlawed it, whereas the United States was struggling with that issue and continued to struggle with it, as we know, until that conflagration of the Civil War.
But lay out your thesis on how the expansion made the Civil War more or less inevitable, if perhaps that's the outcome of the poison Emerson wrote about.
I think it really emerges in the very first Congress and in the Congress after that, after the Treaty of Hidalgo Guadalupe. And the Congress had a significant obligation. It had to establish both governments in these new territories, and it had to establish a means for these territories to become part of the United States as states. And Congress faltered in a very hapless and emotional manner in both of those Congresses. And Polk was president in both of those Congresses, and he was really pulling his hair out, and he was in agony because he kind of saw what he had wrought in a way. And what he had wrought was a reemergence of the slavery issue with much greater intensity than it had ever had before, because the question arose, are we going to have slavery in these territories? Mm-hmm. And when David Wilmot, the freshman congressman from Pennsylvania, rose in the House and issued the so-called Wilmot Proviso, which never became law, but which really stirred up a lot of hornet's nests of anguish and irritation and anger within America, which said essentially that no territory brought into the United States through this war could have slavery. And the South went bonkers over that because they didn't believe that Congress had the right to settle these matters in this way. That pretty much set in motion a whole new course of political debate in America, which led directly to the Civil War.
In 4 short years, he met his every goal. Southwest from Mexico, made sure the tariffs fell and made the English sell the Oregon Territory. He built an independent treasury. Having done all this, he sought no second time. But precious few have mourned the past.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Mexican-American War, the president who drove it, and its resonance today in Arizona and the American Southwest. We're joined this hour by Robert Mary. He's author of A Country of Vast Designs, James K. Polk, The Mexican War, and the Conquest of the American continent. We will be joined as well in just a moment by Marshall Trimble. He is Arizona's state historian. We're really looking forward to getting his perspective on all this. A couple calls first. Lauren in Chester, Connecticut. Lauren, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Thanks for taking the call. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to say I thought it was a very exciting topic because when I was in graduate school 5 years ago, that was really the first time I heard very much about the Mexican-American War, you know, and I was growing up in school.
A lot of primary school textbooks don't make a lot of it.
No, not at all. And certainly not years ago, but at any rate, I was very excited to hear about, you know, the whole story of, you know, how it happened, and then, you know, it sounded to me very much sort of like the kickoff of the Mexican War sounded very much like the Iraq War, the weapons of mass destruction, how that was sort of like not really there. I mean, you know, the whole thing about the conflict is they seem to, like, you know, blow it out of proportion just to start the war.
Abraham Lincoln might have been asking about that if he had been around a century and plus later. Lauren, thanks for your call. Let's get another from Spokane, Washington. Carol, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I taught fourth grade in California for many years, and my job was to teach California state history and also the history of the United States. And for the most part, 13 colonies is a long ways away. And what I wanted to make is you said, what do they teach in the history books? Well, they teach about the California missions and the Spanish in California, but what the parents teach their children is there's a legend of Aztlan, which is the origin of the Aztec people. And they have found in Chaco Canyon in New Mexico a lot of beads and pottery styles, a lot of trade that went on with the Aztecs. But the origin of where they come from, they believe, they teach their children the story of Aztlan, which is from the Nahuatl language of the Aztecs, that's where the Aztecs came from. They do not feel that there is a border. They feel that is the origin of their people, and this is such a huge part of why they are so angry and the passions are stirred up, because it's not just the Mexican-American War. It's how they feel about where they came from as people.
So what do you think then, Carol, when you read the news in Arizona? Of course, they've recently passed this bill, not the immigration bill, but another, the 2281, banning public schools from the public schools ethnic studies courses that promote race consciousness. As a former school teacher in California, how do you look at that?
Why are the graduation rates so low among Hispanics in California, the whole Southwest region? They don't feel that they are valued. They don't feel that their history is, you know, if you believe that your ancestors came from somewhere around New Mexico, Arizona, California, and you're told the 13 colonies and people with white wigs and stockings and buckles on their shoes, they don't see that as their culture. It's the same thing with the Native Americans. Their culture is not valued. If you don't value every culture within the society, if you just say we're all white, we all wear wigs, we have buckles on our shoes, we do Thanksgiving, then you're never going to have them feel that they have value, that they can do well in school, that they can get ahead in life. They're just going to feel that, oh, I'm just going to sell drugs, or I'm just going to, you know, live on the reservation and not in any way try to better my life or the life of my family. You have to value the people. You have to teach their history. You have to understand where they're coming from.
And yet, here we are all these years later, still dealing with issues of territory and culture. Carol, thanks for your call from Spokane. I want to go to Phoenix, Arizona, and to Arizona's state historian Marshall Trimble. He's written a lot of books, Roadside History of Arizona, Arizona, A Cavalcade of History. We're very glad to have him with us today. Marshall Trimble, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom.
So how does all this history run through the debates and controversy we're seeing in Arizona right now? It must be very much on your mind as you watch the current politics play out over immigration, immigrants, the law. How do you see this history?
Well, I've had a long time to look at it. I've been a historian for some 40 years, I guess, and my ancestors first came into Texas about 1840, so mm-hmm. have long, deep roots in the Southwest, and it's interesting. I should point out that when this area became a part of the Guadalupe Hidalgo Treaty, Arizona was pretty much isolated. It was one of those places in between Santa Fe and California, and the destination, and of course the prize in the war, was California,
mm-hmm.
because America was moving west, not north and south.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was to be an ocean-to-ocean power. And there were only about, at the time the United States troops came in to occupy Tucson, and there was only one town in Arizona at that time of any consequence, and that was Tucson. There was a little place called Tubac, which kind of rose and fall with the depending on the Apache raiding, and Tucson was pretty much under siege too. So there were only about 100 armed Mexicans at the time, and 17 Americans at the time the United States Army took over the area. So it was really a remote Arizona. I can't emphasize enough how remote this place was. But interesting, too, the trade was really north and south, Tucson into Guaymas and places like that.
Mm-hmm.
The peso was the dollar, was the money of choice, and so forth.
And the final southern border would not come until 1854 in the Gadsden Purchase, which added that final southern chunk to Arizona and that straight border that we know today, nearly straight, with just about one angle in it there. Why did that piece come later, Marshall Trimble?
Well, the goal here was to build an all-weather railroad, transcontinental railroad, which was later the Southern Pacific Railroad, mm-hmm. and today the interstates. And the mountains just to the north of there were just too daunting to put the railroad in. They didn't know that. Had they asked some of the soldiers, had the politicians bothered to ask, they would have not drawn the line at the Gila River, because to the mm-hmm. north of that is almost impassable. As mm-hmm. they say, not even jackassable, I guess. couldn't even get through there on a mule. But it was, so they needed more land, and there had been a disputed border in the El Paso area because they'd used inaccurate maps. And so they needed to sort out all of these little problems. In fact, the two countries were glaring at each other across the line for until the Gadsden Purchase finally settled the issue pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
But it allowed them to build a railroad, and then Mexico did not want to give up a land route to the Baja, because had they given up that, had they let that line go straight, mm-hmm. it would have been nice for Arizona today. They would have had a seaport,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of people claim that it was just a mistake on the part of the surveyors. They were drinking beer in Nogales, and they heard that the next saloon was in Yuma, and so instead of going straight where they were supposed to go to give us a seaport, it's really an urban legend and a tall tale that's believed by a lot of people. They made a diagonal line up to Yuma.
Right.
Giving us no seaport.
Right.
Well, that wasn't the case at all. Mexico insisted on, they knew that they would lose the Baja by de facto population from Alta, California,
mm-hmm.
if they didn't protect it with a land route.
Marshall Trimble, you're the Arizona state historian, so let me ask you. I mean, here we've got all this controversy and turmoil still today over the border, how unsettled it is, and cultural issues. You know, people listen to this history, and, for example, here's one listener commenting on Facebook. This is a Gabrielle says, that's why the go-home argument doesn't make sense, says this listener. There are many people in Arizona who didn't cross the border. The border crossed them. Does the history help settle this turmoil, Marshall Trimble, or does it rile it up again?
Well, it riles it up, of course. You have there. You know, it's funny. I go back to the times of the Indians. They didn't recognize borders. They knew where somebody else's territory was. Say, mm-hmm. out on the plains or mm-hmm. or the Apache versus the Pima or something. You knew where your boundaries were, and you kind of stayed in them, or you entered the other person's boundary, even with the tribes, at the risk of your own life. And they're just these boundaries are artificial lines, and oftentimes we've seen right here in Arizona where lines were drawn dividing the New Mexico, as an example, when they in 1850 when they made that line across, it separated the Hispanic population from the San Luis Valley in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, that line split the Mormon people in that is today southern Utah and northern Arizona. Mm. These were artificial man-made lines made in Washington. And I think a lot of the same trouble we have today here in Arizona, Arizona's been crying out for the United States Congress to take action for years on this border, border of, you know, immigration reform.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been something that Congress has dodged and dodged and dodged. And America's been, or Arizona, I should say, has been bearing the brunt of these problems, especially along the border. People down there claim they're living in terror because of the smugglers, the drug runners, and the human traffic people.
If I may,
most Arizonans, mm-hmm. that's the most serious complaint mm-hmm. they have today, is that and then there was a rancher murdered on his property.
Yeah, we've heard a lot about it. Yeah,
I think they just had enough.
Mm-hmm. Bob Mary, what would you hope people would take away from the study of history in the midst of the kind of controversy we're still seeing over this territory and borders today, Bob?
Well, I think the caller from Spokane touched on a very significant point, which is that these matters of cultural identity are very powerful. They don't go away. I also think that as I look at history, and I've read a lot of it, that it is largely, if you look at world history, the story of invasions and migrations, and sometimes the difference between one and the other is very difficult to determine. I had heard one time that Gore Vidal said something that sounded like Gore Vidal, but when I tried to Google it so I could get it in the book, I wasn't able to identify it, so I didn't. But I'll quote it now
with the proviso
yeah. that perhaps he didn't say it, but somebody did. He said, according to this, Jimmy Polk stole California from the Mexicans, and now the Mexicans are taking it back. Well, that's kind of the drama here, and it's really part of a unity of history in which these cultural matters and tied to territorial claims become very, very powerful. And just as the people of Mexican heritage feel left out in terms of the studies in their schools, as the caller from Spokane was noting, so do the Anglo-Saxon people when their history is not given what they consider to be due credit by the other side. And so you have this ongoing clash. And I have a feeling that this has a long ways to play out. And I think that it's probably going to become a very, very powerful issue, even more so in the next 20 years and beyond. I believe that history tells us that indistinct borders, borders that aren't clear, borders that are fuzzy, always breed instability, and I think we're going to have a lot of it in our Southwest.
Marshall Trimble, what do you tell your fellow Arizonans if they ask you whose side or what side, if it's possible to frame it that way, history is on here?
It's interesting when we talk about boundaries. One group will say this is we were here first, but that's kind of a relative term, because if anybody had a claim on the land would have been the Native Americans. The Spanish and then later the Mexicans were interlopers, as were the Anglo-American types.
Mm-hmm.
And yet even with the Indians, there was constantly taking a land from stronger tribes, taking it from weaker tribes. So this thing about the stronger taking away from the weak didn't begin with the Spanish, Mexican, and Anglo-Americans. It's been around since mankind. So I look at boundaries and I think, well, it's, a lot of times it's just whoever happens to have more strength to take something and hold it, or more who can outpopulate the other.
Mm-hmm. We've got a call perhaps from James K. Polk's home turf here, Ben in Columbia, Tennessee. Ben, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. It's wonderful to call in, first time calling in. I'm literally from his boyhood hometown, where his only residence he lived in besides the White House still exists.
Wow. Great.
Of course, grew up with a much more extensive knowledge in school of the Mexican-American War and Polk's influence than mm-hmm. probably most kids my age, I'm in my 30s, got in education.
Mm-hmm.
One thing to note is, actually, of all things, the Little Rock, former state capital, has a wonderful history of the Mexican-American War, and was there about a year ago. Has a wonderful exhibit that walks you through the entire war and all the policies and the way the maps changed.
They would have been nearly on the frontier then. Give us your question, Ben. Our time's short.
Sure. My question was, what influence did... I know Jackson and Polk had lots of relations, even down to one of their nieces married one of their nephews. what influence did Andrew Jackson's policies and presidency have on Polk and his actions towards Mexico?
Old Hickory and Young Hickory, as they were called. Bob Murray, we've just got a minute and a half here, but what about that big picture?
Well, very big impact, because I don't think that Jackson had a significant point of view on anything that Polk didn't embrace. And Jackson was very much an expansionist. So Polk embraced the expansionism, unlike some of his competitors for the 1844 Democratic nomination and the presidency. What I would say is that bear in mind that Jackson died at the very beginning of the Polk presidency, and so Polk had to sort of take what he discerned to be Jackson's point of view and run with it on his own, which is what he did.
Marshall Trimble, just half a minute here. Where do you think this history ends, or does it ever end?
I don't think so. It would be nice if we had all, from the very beginning of the Anglo-Americans' arrival in the Southwest, there were cultural differences. I think, as Bob pointed out, religion, law, Roman law versus English common law, the Catholic religion versus the Protestant religion,
mm-hmm.
just big cultural differences between the two. And yet I've seen a mingling in my lifetime here, a very harmonious mixing. I grew up in a town that was mostly Hispanic and northern Arizona. And I've always seen, I just think the more you know people, the more you know about another group, the more respect you developed for them.
Well, there's a hope. There's a good hope to wrap this one on. Marshall Trimble, Arizona State historian, author of Roadside History of Arizona. We're very grateful for your time today. Thank you so much for joining us. And Robert Mary, author of A Country of Vast Designs. Bob, terrific to have you. Thank you very much for being here today.
My pleasure, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.